The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
All right. So this evening I wanted to talk about a quality that is considered one of the important character qualities to develop along the path of Buddhist practice. And this is the quality of, it's usually translated as resolve, but it can also be translated as determination, commitment, conviction, or even what one is devoted to. So this is, I'll give you the Pali word also, it's called adhitana, which I might sometimes say during this talk, because that's the actual word, and then all these other ones are translations, so adhitana. This came to mind because I gave a talk recently. I've been talking recently about patience in a number of venues, and I thought, well, sometimes, you know, people think of patience as having to slow down and be very... some restraint, that kind of thing. So what about this quality of actively moving toward? It seems different, and yet patience is also one of the qualities of character that one should develop. So we're balancing ourselves through these character qualities that are encouraged in practice. So today we're going to focus on this quality of adhitana. I think it's very interesting, and it's also quite foundational, both as a quality of character and as a quality used on walking the path of liberation, however we're doing that in our life right now. So if we want to have kind of a simple definition, we could say that adhitana is the quality of directing the mind toward an aspiration. And we all have aspirations of various kinds, or we have in the past, or... and so... Let's talk about this. There's a kind of sequence of these qualities of character, by the way, which is a little bit significant. Patience, that I just mentioned, comes, and then after that, truthfulness, and then after that, this word, determination or resolve. And I think these kind of go together as a set of three, because you have patience, and then you have this truthfulness, honesty, really seeing things as they are. And my sense from practice is that when we patiently observe the truth for a long time, not like the absolute truth, but we patiently observe what is true in each moment, what is arising, we'll become familiar with how suffering comes about and how the end of suffering can come about. And from that, we are able to, we have enough information, in a sense, to form a coherent aspiration. Then we're like, okay, now I see where I want to go. Generally, we want to go away from suffering. That's what the heart is going to move toward. That's the direction it's going to move toward. And so we have some sense of a clear direction after we have patiently observed how things are for a while. Or we could use more devotional language, if that appeals to your heart more. We can say that we develop some kind of a sacred sense of purpose that arises from deep in our heart, and it's coming forth, being expressed in the world in some way through this quality. In a sense, resolve is the link between intention and action, you know, the idea or the something that emerges in our mind, and then how we bring it forth. And in between, there's a sense of, I want to do this, I'm going to move in this direction. Actually, I think it's a little bit mysterious, and we'll see that later, which is funny for a quality that sounds so crisp and clear, resolve. It's actually somewhat mysterious how that operates and comes about, which we'll see. So, what is it that we resolve upon on the path of practice or in our life? What is that, you know, what is that aspiration that comes forth after we start seeing a little bit from meditation? We start seeing a little bit about how things are. So the kind of generic idea that we get is that we want to move away from suffering and toward freedom or toward our idea of peace or happiness or whatever it is that we are seeking. But there's a lot of possible ways to formulate that or frame it. I would not presume to put an aspiration in your mouth, but let me just talk around some of the different factors that come into this. It certainly depends on our character, depends on the specific context of our situation, and kind of where we are on the path. If we just started meditating this evening, we came to the introductory meditation instruction at 6:15, it might look different than if we've practiced for 42 years, something like that. But this quality is still relevant. It's relevant all along the path, at least until one is completely liberated. An aspiration for a person with a lot of energy and zeal is different than the aspiration for someone who is quiet and introverted. For sure, those are going to look different. Probably the determination of a social activist is different than the determination of a hospice chaplain. It depends what you're doing, your situation that you're in. And as I said, the aspirations that we have early in practice will almost certainly change as we gain more experience with the path. Now, if you're sitting here thinking, I don't know if I'm going to sit through this whole talk because I don't really feel sure about anything like that right now, or I don't feel wise enough to choose something like that right now, I would encourage you to sit through it anyway. In that, I actually had this concern at the beginning of my path. It was kind of, well, I'm not wise. That's why I'm practicing. I really need something here. But if I'm not wise, how am I going to be wise enough to choose how to practice? How am I going to be wise enough to choose an aspiration? It felt like kind of a catch-22. But what I learned over time is that whatever wisdom we have at this moment, which is always non-zero, we start with some degree of wisdom, whatever we have is enough to choose the next thing and to move in the next, take the next step on the path or to move in the next direction that we need to go. And then from there, we'll get a different perspective and we can refine or do something else. So wherever you are, and you don't need to have an aspiration at all times. That I want to be clear about also. If you're sitting here thinking, no, what I'm really in the letting go phase. I would like to just open and see what comes. That is beautiful also. Of course, that might be an aspiration to open and to sit still and to wait in a certain, listen deeply and see what's going to come. So it doesn't have to look like some kind of a strong movement toward, even if my language sounds a little bit like that this evening. So I just want to honor where everybody is regarding this particular quality. It might be useful to know that there are some specific aspirations that are offered in the written teachings of the Buddha and also in the later commentaries. So there are four particular resolves offered in the earliest teachings: the resolve for wisdom, for truth, for relinquishment or generosity, and for peace, which I think are lovely. And then in the more modern kind of Burmese Theravadan tradition, it is said that one should resolve on the seven factors of awakening, which are mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And I think we could resolve on all these qualities of character. I won't name them all, but there are 10 of these qualities. I talked about patience, truthfulness, and resolve being a little set. There's actually a total of 10. We can resolve on any of those. So note that these are all kind of beautiful and lofty qualities, things like peace and wisdom and energy and joy and tranquility. And I've found that by kind of putting those out there as, you may want to consider these as aspirations, sometimes people feel shy about that, and they say, oh, I don't know if I can wish for something so beautiful for myself. But I want to, first of all, encourage that and say, actually, those very beautiful things are completely available to us, and that they're not at all selfish or kind of aggrandizing to wish for those. It's really okay. Even if you just do it totally silently inside, you wouldn't think about sharing it with your friends. You can resolve on these things. But truly, actually, we can have even more everyday sounding aspirations that are just as meaningful. We might resolve to give up smoking or give up overeating. We can make a wish that we will learn to stop interrupting people if that's one of our habits when we're talking. We realize, that's part of the patience and the truthfulness. You see, oh, you know, it's true. That's how things are. And so then we say, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to refrain from that. One that I had early in my practice, actually for a couple of years, right near the beginning, was I had a sort of a ongoing determination that I would be devoted to relaxing my body in all situations. And I needed this because when I started, I was I was pretty tense physically, just out of habit, really. And I noticed that right away when I started meditating, how I held myself, basically, in kind of a braced position. And so I just made it a habit. That was kind of my meditation practice, my daily mindfulness practice, was to notice, am I tightening up? Am I holding myself against the chair? I used to even, like when I was eating, my arms against the table would kind of be pushing, like bracing against the table. And so I just devoted myself to relaxing. And I find now that just happens habitually. I don't have as much issue with that. I've loosened up a lot. But it then kind of is incorporated into just, there's just kind of this little background check now and then. Oh, am I holding anywhere? So these daily life aspirations are, of course, more common. We'll have many of them along our path. And I've noticed over time, since I've had a number of them, that they provide kind of a critical infrastructure in our heart as we're that serves us all along the path. We build these little ways that we're checking ourselves and caring for ourselves moment to moment through these very simple aspirations that we carry along. So you might take a moment right now to consider what it is that you're currently devoted to in your kind of everyday practice. You know, what is it that you're, some people like to say working on, but I don't want to use that phrase. Just what are you devoted to? What are you thinking about? What's up in your practice? And then, you know, is there a way that you can, at this moment, set that intention again? So as we explore and become interested in this quality of adhitana, our ability to make a determination, we do come to recognize that kind of partial, half-hearted commitment to the path is not going to be sufficient in the long run. Judy Leaf says, no matter how much we have studied or how many ideas we may have, without exertion, our understanding will be superficial, not transformative. So adhitana is kind of an oomph factor in our practice at the times when we need it. You know, again, there are times when we're letting go. There's like climbing up the ladder and then there's sliding down the slide. And this is a little bit about climbing up the ladder. But there's a lot of ladders that are worth climbing. So as is often true, when we start thinking about something, whether it's resolve or metta or being able to follow my breath, usually what happens is that we run into what prevents us from doing that. We run into the obstacles. That's just how mindfulness works, actually. It's designed to show us the places where we're asleep. And so it's actually sometimes more fruitful to notice where we're being stopped or blocked or held back than it is to kind of focus on some kind of ideal and say, I'm resolved on wisdom. I'm going to be wise every moment. And you just try to look at that. Then you're trying to push stuff out of the way. But actually, it can help to then refocus your attention and say, wait a minute, why is this not happening? Like, what is this that's right in front of me here? Take a look at the obstacle. So let's consider what hindrances there are to being able to have an aspiration, have a goal. What hinders our ability to pursue these things? Some of the distractions, basically they're distractions, some of them come externally, actually, from society. In some cases, I think I'll just give one that's specific to the practice world. Ironically, we may lack determination because in some ways the teachings are very readily available, especially around here, especially on the internet. I ran across this interesting quote from a Tibetan nun. In past ages, spiritual aspirants underwent difficulty to meet teachers. Tibetans traversed the high Himalayas to meet wise mentors in India. Chinese crossed the Taklamakan Desert and Karakoram Mountains to attend monasteries and bring back scriptures from India. But we have different expectations. We think, why should I have to travel to attend teachings? We have jobs, families, such busy lives. We don't have time to cross town, let alone go to another continent. Forgetting that the seeker's very effort and struggle open him or her to the teachings, we resent that our spiritual practice should impinge upon our preferences. So I know that's not that easy to hear sometimes. I'm actually very appreciative that all of you got across town to come here. I know it may not have been easy. You may have been at work all day. It may not have been a very positive day at work, but here you are. So I think that sometimes coming across town is like crossing the high Himalayas. But there's a certain, if you relax, there's a certain truth to this. It's very easy to meet teachers and to run into teachings in this particular area. And I wonder how different it might have been to practice when you really did have to go somewhere and put on your pack and travel several nights to meet a teacher just to receive these precious teachings. But if all the blocks were external, I think they'd be overcome pretty easily. Actually, we know that many of the problems come internally, right, from our own heart. So really, any of the five hindrances, the five classical challenges in the mind that prevent us from being present or from being able to gather the mind, any of the five hindrances can be a problem. And that list of five is sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. And I would add fear as another one, as for reasons that we think we can't have an aspiration, have a beautiful wish for ourselves. For example, though, consider doubt. That's a common one. We wonder if all this striving is really good for us. We worry that we don't have sufficient wisdom yet to know what to strive for. And so then all this doubt comes masquerading as wisdom, and it sounds very logical. You know, our mind puts up all these reasons why, oh, I couldn't do that. I don't think that would be right for me. I'm not really sure. I don't know what I want, etc. Interestingly, there's a teaching from the Buddha where he identifies a whole bunch of views that are basically not helpful for advancing on the path. And there's a set of them that are based on somebody saying, I forget how many, a few, that are based on somebody saying, well, because I'm not totally sure, I'm not going to commit to this. You know, because I'm not totally sure what's right and what's wrong, I'm not going to declare any ethical stance in the world. Or because I'm not sure what's wise and unwise, because I'm still a traveler on the path, I'm not going to commit to any particular practices and teachings. And he clumps all of these views together under a set called the Eel Wriggling Views, which I think is a lovely name. So this doubt, I mean, it's a real thing, doubt. It comes masquerading as wisdom, just as an FYI, all those lawyers in our head. Sometimes we just need to step back and say, ah, this is doubt. Right. This is doubt. It's hard to do. Doubt is hard to see. So we have these various hindrances of things that we want sensually, ill will, like not liking somebody or not liking a situation and just wanting to push back from that. Challenges with energy, so low energy or agitation, and then this doubt and also fear, I'm adding in this case. So how do these, you know, affect our being able to make reasonable steps along the path, or how can we deal with them? I advocate a kind of a Aikido move. Do you guys know what Aikido is? Where you kind of, something comes at you and you redirect the force away from you, essentially. So we can, if we have these hindrances that are blocking our ability to make a resolution, to make a resolve, then we can resolve not to be caught by the hindrances. You know, forget about the resolve for peace, just resolve not to be caught so much by my anger. And then, you know, that's an intermediate aim. And when we are good at that Aikido move, then we'll be actually one step closer to peace, because truthfully, not getting caught by anger is a great step toward being more peaceful, for example, if that's the hindrance that you're working with. There's also a very nice practice that Gil talks about that is strengthens both adhidhana and wisdom. And you can try it anytime at home. I'll just tell you about it. And it also weakens the hindrance of desire. And it's called riding out a desire. It's a fun one. So notice sometime, just in case some desire happens to arise for you during the day, notice when you really want something that's relatively small, like a snack. Say you're sitting at the computer, you want a snack. Probably you're not going to starve if you don't get the snack. If you are, please eat the snack. But most of us, probably we can go for a little while without a snack. And so then you have this desire, you notice it's there. If we're not too mindful, we'll just get up and get it. But if you want to try this practice, don't fulfill that desire immediately. Actually sit and feel, but don't distract yourself. Don't like turn back and say, I'm going to go back to this web page and I'm just going to forget about it. Stop what you're doing and feel that desire. And really feel, okay, what does this desire for snack or coffee or tea feel like right now? And you may be interested to really feel what the effect of desire on the body is. Depending what the desire was, some people actually shake or sweat while feeling the desire. And it might actually be really hard for a while. But eventually, and I'm telling you the end so that you'll be able to stick with it, eventually that desire will actually end, even if it's not fulfilled. It will start to diminish because the conditions for it will fall apart. It turns out the attention on the desire will eventually have that effect. And so what we learn at some level, what the heart learns is that desire ends without the desire being fulfilled. We know that desire ends when it's fulfilled. You know, if I want a sip of water and I reach down and I get my glass, the desire has ended for that sip. I got it. maybe. Who's the I? But that's the usual way that we think our desires will be resolved. But actually, if we wait long enough, the desire does end by other means, by the fact that the conditions for it fall apart, and so there's wisdom being learned. This is not to say you should never fulfill any desires. If you have the desire to use the restroom, please fulfill that at some point. But this is a very interesting practice to start getting some wisdom around the flow of the way desire works. And it also, of course, strengthens resolve, because while you're sitting there not fulfilling the desire, you are strengthening adhidhana, even though it's just a short-term determination. So it's a good practice. I hope you'll enjoy it. And then you can go have the snack after that. But it may not taste the same. In general, though, I'll just say that these hindrances are not to be struggled against. I mean, to some degree, you're riding out a desire. You are going to thwart. You're going to thwart a hindrance. But be careful that the attitude is not, I'm going to overpower this. I'm going to kill it. I'm going to, etc. I'm going to squash this thing. It's really more like it's going to dissolve. If you wait, it's going to dissolve. Now, isn't it interesting that resolve and dissolve are pretty similar, right? To resolve, like a cord is resolves or something dissolves. It's the same root. So we're now getting into kind of the how of working with an aspiration. There's what we're resolved upon, and then there's how we go about pursuing it. Those are both really important dimensions. So I will say that the Buddha, in his words and his example, he did advocate strenuous effort. You can't read the teachings and not come to this conclusion. He says things about, people who are lazy don't find the way to enlightenment. And his own resolution was, willingly let only my skin, sinews, and bones remain, and let the flesh and blood dry up in my body, but I will not relax my energy so long as I have not attained what can be attained by human strength, energy, and exertion. And he goes on to say that his disciples should have the same attitude. However, so I wanted to read that because it's in there. But taking this teaching literally, I think, is not very helpful in our modern goal-oriented world. We live in a very different place than India 2,600 years ago. We often push too hard, physically damaging our bodies and creating serious mental issues, a lot of stress. So a lot of Western teachers emphasize much more a path of relaxation and letting go, kind of successively disengaging from our drivenness. And this is a very good path for overachievers and workaholics, which we have a few of in this area. So this is, I think, just a different kind of resolve, because there's a lot of momentum in wanting to work a lot, wanting to achieve, wanting to look good in a certain way. And there can be some real determination in saying, no, I'm going to have compassion at this moment, and I'm not going to work that extra hour, or I'm not going to go in on Saturday in this case, or something. And if you start looking with this lens at the teachings, actually the Buddha offered guidance along these lines too. It wasn't all about nose to the grindstone. The Buddha himself practiced, as you may know, I don't know if you know the whole story of the Buddha, but he practiced austerities for a number of years, like physically torturing himself in the belief that he needed to subdue his body and his mind in order to achieve enlightenment. And he discovered it did not work. It did not work. He practiced these self-mortification things, and it just didn't, he didn't get any wiser. After a while, he said, wait a minute, I'm not any wiser than I was when I started all this, and I'm starving. And then he took some food, and he remembered a time from his own childhood when he was happy, relaxed, content, and his mind was concentrated. His mind became gathered. He actually attained a state of concentration while sitting under a tree. And he had this thought, maybe that's the path. And then he said, yes. This middle way between practicing austerities and pushing ourselves and kind of sensual indulgence, or just, have the chocolate cake when you get stressed. Neither of those is a path that really works. I think we can see that intuitively. And down the middle is some kind of a path of gentle engagement, having a sense of when to apply energy and when to let go, keeping the mind fixed on what's going away from suffering and what's going toward freedom. Looking at those kinds of things. in a kind of a continual way, continual, gentle, resolved. So this is, would be maybe correct aditana or wise aditana, like wise view, wise effort, these steps of the path. This is like wise aditana. So striving, you know, you do have to do the work, but doing so in a way that's not harmful to ourselves or others. This alone is actually a huge exploration in our life. It can be a big part of our path to figure out how to be strong, determined, and also wise and compassionate. This is a way of sort of combining wisdom with this factor on the path. And this means that in doing so, we'll learn about our own mind, because we have a particular kind of mind. Everybody has a little few different qualities to their mind. And so to figure out what about for me, for this mind, you know, for some people, riding out a desire is a great practice for them, and they do it once and they say, this is it. I'm going to work on this for a while. This is really meaningful to me. And someone else will try it and say, why in the world did Kim recommend that? That was really stupid. It didn't get my, you know, engage me at all. And so we'll need to check, you know, what practices seem to be working for us, what ones push us just the right amount. It has actually been shown, you know, now looking more in the realm of psychology, it's been shown that people do the best in terms of how happy and fulfilled they are when they have an optimal amount of challenge. And actually, if we're understimulated and kind of things are too easy, the mind starts to wander off and not do well. You know, like children who are maybe in a grade too young for them. They're not challenged. They start getting in trouble. The mind will get in trouble. On the other hand, we know that pushing too hard, also the mind starts to get unhappy, it gets tight, it gets angry, it gets resentful, you know, and then we start doing things that aren't helpful for our health. So we learn to work in that range of optimal challenge, which sometimes is a lot of challenge. Sometimes we really want to go. I had a period in my practice where I did an incredible amount of residential retreat. Like I think over, in one period I did over a 9-month period, I did 6 months of retreat, something like that. There were a couple breaks in there. But I was just really on that track and I needed to do that. And then there are other times where the optimal level of challenge was, I'm going to clear my calendar and actually have a week to read. I haven't read enough recently, and you know, this is what I need. So we need to feel for ourselves, and then that's also the wisdom. We feel for ourselves how much challenge is right for me right now that's going to keep my mind engaged, keep my heart happy, keep me interested in my path. So Aditana itself is kind of a path, right? I talked about how learning about how to work with our mind, how to find the right level of engagement, the right amount of energy to put out, that in itself is a whole realm of practice. And it forms kind of a path. And I think there's kind of two different ways that Aditana functions on our path. I'm using the Pali word, this word for resolve. One that's kind of conscious and intentional, and then there's Aditana that's not. And I just want to talk about each of those briefly. So there are determinations that we make consciously. Like I mentioned that earlier, I said take a moment to think about what's up for you in practice, what might you be working on right now, or thinking about, or curious about, or exploring. And these are the ones that we take up consciously and maybe check our progress after a year. How's that working out? Please don't check every day. It's too often. But just now and then, reflecting, what's up for me now and how's that going and has anything changed? Can be simple things like resolving to sit every day. And maybe you don't right away. You know, you say, I'm going to sit every day. And after a week, you say, okay, I did it twice. And then you say, I'm going to sit every day. And after another month, you realize that out of those 28 days, you did it 15. You say, huh, that's pretty interesting. And then you say, oh, I like this. I'm starting to notice the effects of sitting more. So you keep having that resolve. And, you know, maybe you decide to sit every day, and over the next 6 months you sit, oh dear, how many days is that? Well, you sit 5.5 every day. Yeah, so making a determination is not a neutral act, actually. The very act of considering, this is something that I want to do. I'm interested in this. I'm devoted to this. Choose the language that works for you. It actually channels and focuses and shapes our intentions and our energy and the way things flow. And if we resolve to have pizza and beer every night, that's going to be different than if we resolve to sit every day. It really does matter what we do with our mind. Sometimes in ways that are a little surprising, like we don't know how things will unfold necessarily when I direct our mind in a certain direction. But so I'm not saying there's control here, but there is definitely effect. There's no aspiration that has no effect on the mind or on your life. So this is interesting and a little powerful. And these conscious ones are very important along the path. You'll also read teachings that say, you know, you shouldn't have any aims. Practice has no goal. It's continual. It's all about just letting go and being in the here and now. The future doesn't exist. Does this contradict with those? I don't know. There are different ways of seeing things, and a resolve, actually, in my understanding, from my own practice, a resolve is a present moment activity. So right here in the here and now, I can resolve not to be caught by anger in this very moment. It's still a resolution. And part of maturing in the art of resolution is to not be tied to a particular result. Yeah, so this is how there's no contradiction between views of there's no future, don't have any goals, with views of you have to have some kind of intention. Intention is a factor in the present moment. And as long as we're not thinking, okay, it's got to be X by tomorrow, or it has to look like such and such when it emerges. You know, I'm going to be a great meditator by a year from now, and what it's going to look like is that I can sit down and achieve the first jhana every time. You know, it doesn't quite work like that. You can resolve to be an excellent meditator in some way, but then you can't determine what that's going to look like. That's one of the rules. So I just throw that in because I don't want people to get confused by going and reading some Zen teachings that tell you that there's no aim and that goals are bad. There are ways in which these are not contradictory teachings. Okay, and this is another way to resolve, I'm using that word, to resolve that apparent contradiction, which is that we will also come to experience on our path determination that does not come from the self. So all these ones about I'm going to do this or I would like to have such and such, these are in a way self-generated. And it's okay, we can resolve to improve in various ways. We can make an effort with our will, or believe that we're making an effort with our will. But there are also kind of a profound manifestation of adhitana that's a long-term trajectory of the heart on a path toward freedom. And this is something that we can only see when we look back after a while. And the path continually unfolds, often in ways that we can't understand. There's a yearning in the heart, or there's a movement that's bringing us into situations that help us be free, that's only going to exhaust itself when we get to liberation. You don't have to be in touch with this or understand it or know what it is. Just know that it's there. We can't actually do the whole path. We can't do it. But it will be done. It will be done. So Here's some things that help point toward that. Ajahn Suchito says, over time, my resolve energy has simplified and calmed to one of sustaining the attitude, may this action or thought be for my welfare, the welfare of others, and lead to peace. This resolve doesn't make a self out of intention or results. It just holds experience carefully and lets it pass through and dissolve. This is beautiful and selfless. The self does not do it. So he says it's an attitude. May this action or thought be for my welfare, the welfare of others, and lead to peace. It's like an attitude of the mind in the moment. It's not about, and it's going to look like, and it's going to happen by next week. Completely in the present moment and not generated by his self. And then also want to read some lines from an email that was sent from a friend of mine who went to Burma and ordained as a monk. And he was kind of in this devotional space. And he wrote an email back to his friends in the U.S. and he wrote, I know you are all moving towards freedom and wisdom in your own individual ways, whether seen or unseen, whether in retreat or in full catastrophe living. I really trust this process in each of us more than I trust myself. Yeah, so there's a process going on, and it's very beautiful to be devoted to that in some way. So I'll stop there and ask if there are any questions or comments. We can have a microphone if anyone has one. Yes, in the back there.
I have sort of a question because I kind of have my own method of pursuing aspiration. I'm really good at the beginner's mind. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know a lot of the time. But I'm on the path, and that's where I want to be, and I understand where the path is for me.
Yep.
And the thing I found out is that when I do unskillful things, which I do a lot, 5 minutes, 10 minutes later, I feel, why did I do that? Why did I say that? What? On, on, on. But when I do something that's more skillful, more appropriate, it brings me joy.
Mm.
Not gratification. Eat a candy bar, you get gratification. It's desire. That doesn't work. And I follow that lead. Through 100 little steps, I've ended up as a volunteer setting with hospice patients.
Mm.
And people say, why do you do that? Because it brings me joy.
Uh-huh.
I mean, to be allowed to become friends with someone at what is potentially the most important time in their life is wonderful.
It's quite a gift, isn't it?
It's joyful when I do it, and after I do it, and forever. So for me, aspiration, do things that make me joyful, because that only happens when I'm following the path.
Hmm.
So is that... You mentioned joy in there a little bit, but
it seems like you were
focusing more on resolve. Am I not understanding?
Oh, well, so you're using joy as kind of the breadcrumb, is what I hear. You know, it's like there's a path that's created for you by moving in the direction that brings joy at that moment. You're absolutely right that skillful behavior tends to have the result of happiness. These are the first two lines of the Dhammapada, where it says, you know, speak or act. The second one is speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. And so, we can turn that around and say, oh, if I move in the direction of the happiness or the joy, that will be related to a mind that is acting peacefully, yeah? And so I think it works well along the path. Now, The only thing I'll add to that, because I don't want to discourage anything along this line, is that freedom is not any particular experience. So joy is part of the path, and then freedom is more about the relationship to experience that's arising, whether it's joyful or not. So say you act unskillfully and you feel 5 minutes later, why did I do that? There can be freedom in that moment if you don't cling to that disappointment or sense that I didn't want to do that. You just feel that, okay, a little bit of regret. There is actually freedom in that moment, even though there's no joy. Do you see the difference? And so, but moving along in the direction of joy and doing more and more things that are skillful places your mind in a better and better state to really realize liberation. So that's why it's the path. Does that clear up some of the vocabulary? Okay. Great.
Hi. I have a question regarding what you were saying about your resolve, and that could be being calm and peaceful for me. But then my hindrance to that is being really competitive and being in a really competitive industry. And that's almost the reason why I want to be more calm and peaceful, because I just have so much going on at all times. And how do you... So this talk today made me realize what my hindrance was, which made me realize why it's almost so difficult for me to reach my resolve of being calmer and more peaceful, because I feel like they're two contradictory things. So I guess how would I go about reaching my resolve with that as being my hindrance?
So you're looking two blocks ahead at peace and calm, but one block ahead is competitiveness and agitation. Keeping thinking, okay, I've got to get to that place that's 100 yards away, when you've got an obstacle 50 yards away, the way to handle that is to bring your focus back and focus 50 yards ahead instead of 100 yards, and notice, really focus on that obstacle that's there, not focus like direct all your attention toward and really absorb into it, but really feel... there are conditions under which I am doing the opposite of what I really am aiming for in the long run, right? So there are conditions where you mentioned that you're in a competitive industry. Do you behave in that competitive way also? Are you drawn into that by the... Yeah. And that's natural, by the way. It's not a personal failing, because that's what's encouraged in that situation. So what I have found in working with these are essentially contradictory desires. You have one desire for peace, and you have an activity, which is still a desire because you're doing it, toward competitiveness or keeping up. Probably if you look underneath that, there's a sense of, I have to do this because I'm among these people and this is what you do in this situation. Or I want to keep my job, or I want to, look okay for my family and my boss or something. There's some relationship in there. I have found one method is to hold all of that at once and to feel the different pulls. It can take some determination to be able to hold competing desires, because desires often compete. That's one of the problems with desires. They can't all be fulfilled at once. So we have to find another way. But this will help the heart to really feel both the sense of longing for the peace and the calm, which is very real, and feel the kind of the hardness around the competitiveness and the hard work that you're doing, and kind of let those touch each other in awareness. And sometimes this may not be a very pleasant experience, but sometimes through that, a path can open where, you know, and this is where you're really paying attention to that barrier in addition to the thing beyond it that you're looking toward. And that has the effect of shifting the barrier in certain ways or seeing a crack in it, seeing a way around it, something like that. But something will have to change. Something's going to change. And, you know, what are you prepared to change? Yeah. But I would leave it to mindfulness. Mindfulness will help you see that path. You don't have to rush it or do anything drastic. Yeah. It's a great question. I really love that you're asking these questions of your life. Yeah.
So I've grown up in practicing a sect of Buddhism in which we chant, and when we chant for ourselves and for others.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, in terms of resolve, I'm thinking of a couple of years ago when my uncle had cancer, and so the whole family was basically chanting for him to get better.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, unfortunately, he passed away.
Mm.
But I'm wondering, you know, in, I guess, this particular practice, how do you deal with that when the resolve or when your aspiration is not something you yourself can actively do,
but yeah,
involves somebody else?
Yeah, this is sort of the art of wishes like this. I didn't ever use the word wish tonight, but for those of you who are familiar with metta practice, for instance, this is a practice of wishing well for others. And so we wish, for example, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, may you be healthy. And sometimes people find this practice just lovely. And, you know, in the case of your uncle, you were chanting, you know, may his health be restored. I'm not exactly sure what words you were using, but okay, you're nodding. That was the sentiment. And sometimes people come up against this and say, well, but he's dying of cancer, or you're sitting with someone on hospice, they're going to die. You know, it's not like this. Sometimes it's a situation that we can't actually affect because it's a choice the other person has to make. They might go to AA or they might not. It's going to be their choice, but we wish in our mind, please let them find the support that they need for this issue. And I think here we can say the resolve still has an impact on the universe. We may just not know how it is. I won't go so far as to say we are directly influencing the flow of their karma. I don't think we need to know that. But it certainly influences our own heart. Your family probably really came together over your uncle's illness. And in some way, there was a lot of benefit. And he also knew that you were caring for him. Even though he died hearing that chant and knowing that you had come there for him. So in a way, the conditions of his mind were as good as they could have been at the moment of death because of that. So this is part of this this aspect I said of not holding on to the way the result is going to look. We make the wish, we extend our heart in that direction, or as Ajahn Sucitto says, we sustain the attitude, which is a present tense thing, may this action or thought be for my welfare, the welfare of others, and lead to peace. But we let it go after that. We just have that attitude. And so kind of the way that we make the wish has as much effect as the wish itself, probably more. Yeah, does that help? Yeah. Okay, it's a little over time, so we'll end, but if anyone has more, I can stay. Thank you.